Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello again, and welcome to My Time Capsule. My name is Mike Fenton Stevens, and My Time Capsule is the podcast where I ask people to tell me the four things from their life they cherish so much that they would like to preserve them in a time capsule, and the one thing in their life they find embarrassing or annoying or even unjust and would like to bury in the ground and never have to think about again. My guest in this episode is the actress, comedian, and impressionist Jan Ravens. Famous for the myriad voices she has contributed to Spitting Image and the long-running BBC Radio 4 comedy Dead Ringers. But that hardly covers Jan's extraordinary career. She was the first female president of the Cambridge Footlights. She became a radio comedy producer, a very male world at that time, and then started performing as one of the cast of Jasper Carrot's massive 1980s comedy series Carrot's Lib, as a regular voice on Spitting Image, and as a radio presenter for Capital Radio in Brunch with her then-husband Steve Brown, and DJs Paul Burnett and Roger Scott, and the comedy writers and performers Jeremy Pascal and Angus Deaton. She has done the voiceover for a multitude of adverts. She's guested on Just a Minute, Sorry I Haven't a Clue, QI, Whose Line Is It Anyway, and Have I Got News For You, and she won Celebrity Mastermind. She also partnered Anton Dubek in the 2006 series of Strictly Come Dancing. And she's worked at the RSC. But luckily, she was able to find time to talk to me about the five things she'd put in a time capsule. And here they are, as chosen by the lovely Jan Ravens.
You know, your first job, you have to be sort of, like, I don't know if you remember, I've sort of worked hard to make everybody forget, but I did this thing called Just Amazing with Barry Sheen and Kenny Lynch, which was like, you know, peak time Saturday night shit. and spent years kind of trying to live it down, you know.
And when it's all those things, you sort of choose comedy. I went into comedy because I went to the Edinburgh Festival with three very serious plays.
Yeah.
And doing the late night review for the fun of it.
Yeah.
And there I am.
Yeah.
Comedy.
Yeah. I know, but I think it's in you as well. I mean, I mean, both of us do the other stuff. But if comedy's in you, you sort of can't keep it out.
No, I know. I have that problem when I do serious plays. But I think it's important in serious plays to find the humour in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, although not always.
Oh, you've seen me act then.
Yeah. Oh, but this too solid flesh would melt, eh? Could do with melting a bit of this. Whoa.
I know. Great. Okay. Right. Well, Jan, welcome to my time capsule. So what's your first item?
My first item is, this is my first item. It's a pretty cup and saucer. And my pretty cup and saucer that I'm putting in the time capsule belonged to my nanny. And I used to go round to my nanny's house on Saturday morning to get my one and threepence pocket money. And she would make me a cup of coffee, which in those days was like powdered Nescafe with boiled milk on it. I mean, just disgusting. But it came in this beautiful cup. And I think it was the first time that I sort of became aware of like domestic things being lovely. Because I used to really look forward to this cup of coffee in this beautiful, it's a thin china cup. Mm. And it's pale pink with pale green flowers and very, very delicate china. I mean, you know how now people go into, you know, coffee shops and so, and they come out with these bloody buckets of coffee, these great sort of swilling buckets of sort of milky froth. And I kind of think, oh, you know, I just sort of love the kind of the diminutive quality of this coffee and the sort of delicacy of the cup. And like I say, it was the first time that I'd ever been aware of domestic things being beautiful. Because, I mean, our house was like, it was sort of utilitarian, I guess. I mean, a lot of things like, you know, the crockery was from the Green Shield Stamps catalogue. Yeah. And the fabrics and the furnishings. I remember there was a lot of Dreylon. that sort of Dreylon that goes when you sort of rub it, you know, the wrong way.
My mother kept the covers on the sofa for a long time when she bought
it. What, the polythene covers?
Yeah.
Ooh, that's sweaty. Mm. And I also remember actually at home, we had, it was the 70s or the 60s and 70s. So everything was like psychedelic. There were lots of psychedelic patterns and lots of orange and brown and mustard, all the sort of most horrible colours together in these sort of swirly patterns. And I remember we had these curtains and my mum would make the curtains and she would go and get the fabric from Birkenhead Market. And this fabric that she bought was actually, it was fiberglass. Oh, that's great, that love, you know, it'll do you great, that love, you know, oh, it'll be sound, you know, there you go, you got this fiberglass, you know, very hard wear. And it was like, again, it was like sort of, had this sort of horrible feel, fiberglass curtains and Dreylon sofas. So my nan's house, where there were these lovely Adderley fine bone china cups, it sort of opened my eyes to how your home or things in your home could be beautiful.
Yeah.
And then we started going to my godmother's cottage for our holidays, and she had some really lovely, like, Sanderson fabrics in this little cottage in Wales, where we had to go every bloody year, incidentally. anyway, because I'm actually a Taurus. This is very, you know, hello. Don't say she's talking about star signs, but I'm a Taurus, and you know, Taurians apparently are renowned for sort of like being home loving and loving sort of fabrics and, you know, being tactile. I mean, I always sort of say, you know, yes, I'm a Taurian, earthy, passionate, and prone to run to fat. So I blame this kind of this sort of early love of kind of, you know, I sort of had my eyes open to the beauty. It's like a William Morris thing, I suppose, you know, don't have anything in your house that isn't beautiful or useful. And
so is it sort of a reaction to that 60s and 70s thing where everything was new and you got rid of everything old? So in fact, all those older things are sort of delicate, more subtle in a way, aren't they?
Well, also, I think certainly at that point, it wasn't like my parents had the sort of the new things that were like cutting edge design. They were just a bit shit, actually. and so I think, yes, there was the sort of, it was a love of old things. And then, of course, when I went to Cambridge and I'd go back to sort of friends' houses, and I remember a lot of people having these houses that had this kind of easy comfort. I guess it was the sort of early, because this was like the mid to late 70s. It was sort of like shabby chic, which became a thing kind of later on. But it was that thing of things being old, but kind of rather lovely.
Yes.
And not being sort of new and Dreylon and fiberglass. They were kind of, you know, these beautiful old chintzes and lovely old wooden carved tables and things like that, but that, which weren't sort of like bright and shiny and new, but they were beautiful.
It's a sort of ease that the gentry have, isn't it?
Yes, all those houses you go to and think, wow, this is a whole new world.
How did you get to that world, Jan? That's extraordinary. I mean, clearly through hard work and working hard at school, but it's a big jump, isn't it, Birkenhead?
It was my art teacher, really. My art teacher directed the school plays, and she was this woman called Mary Metcalf, and she was sort of like, she had these sort of very slim sort of Bambi-ish legs with very sort of fine ankles and a well-turned calf. And she was one of those teachers, I don't know if you had them in your school, she would make all her own dresses, but she'd sort of have one pattern, but make this one pattern in all different fabrics. And it was very fitted. She had very good breasts, very slim waist, and so she had this flowing dress going out to just on the knee. And she was had beautiful auburn hair and freckly and very toothy, and she was quite sexy, I suppose, for thinking back on it. But she would direct the school plays, and I really wanted to be an actress, you know, from being quite young, because I was from the same town, small town, as Glenda Jackson. And so I thought, oh, if Glenda can do it, I can get out, you know, I can go to the RSC, I can be in a Hollywood movie. So I really wanted to be Glenda Jackson, you know, and the heart and stomach of a king and a king of England too, and all that business. And so anyway, I couldn't go to drama school because you couldn't get a grant to go to drama school, but you could get a grant to go to teacher training college. And my art teacher, who did the school plays, she'd been to Homerton in Cambridge, which was the teacher training college. Oh, you must go to Homerton, you know, punting on the backs and all that, and marvellous. And I thought, well, that's a good alternative. You know, I can do drama at Cambridge. And then because my dad and I had always watched, you know, things like Monty Python and Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and stuff on the telly, I had an inkling of the whole kind of Footlights thing. And so I thought, yeah, Cambridge would be a good place to go. And I went down for an interview, you know, and it was so beautiful. Mm. And my God, you know, teaching practice, God, that's the hardest thing you'll ever do. Bloody hell. I've got such admiration for teachers because it's the hardest job in the world. I mean, you know, if you're in a play, okay, you've got to go on stage, but there's no tougher audience than a class full of kids. Because, you know, an audience aren't going to go, hey, miss, you know, they're not going to start, well, hopefully, they're not going to start heckling you. But, yeah, class full of kids is a really tough audience. Mm. So I was a bit of a fish out of water. I mean, I did feel kind of, certainly when I started doing plays, because, you know, you do the plays with all the people from all the university colleges. Homerton was full of, like, grammar school girls like me, or actually much more assiduous than me, very, very studious. And they would sort of like, you know, take very careful notes at every lecture and then regurgitate them. It was a kind of continuation of the grammar school education in lots of ways. Mm. But it did actually open my eyes politically being at Homerton because because of studying education and talking about the psychology of education and the sociology of education and equality of educational opportunity and all that kind of thing. I mean, it really opened my eyes a lot because although we'd been, you know, we didn't have any money when I was a kid, my family, I mean, my mother in particular was very sort of, they've all got satellite dishes. They all smoke. You know, she was very sort of unforgiving of people who kind of couldn't get on with it because she was such a sort of getter on with it.
So do you think that that your chameleon nature, which you're sort of famous for, really, did you develop that before you went there? Or was it a result of, you know, when you go to these places, you really think you must turn up with a chip on your shoulder, don't you? Because you think these posh people are not going to want me in their gang.
Well, looking back on it, I mean, it sort of goes two ways, really, because while I felt very sort of out of place and insecure and imposter syndrome and all that, I also look back at what I did and I was infused with this kind of amazing confidence. I mean, in my first year, I think I wrote and directed a musical based on around Beatles songs called Every Person, which was like the Everyman story, only it was called Every Person and it was about a woman sort of trying to find herself in, you know, the modern world kind of thing. And it was all done with the characters from Everyman, the medieval mystery play, and written around Beatles songs. And I sort of think, and it was like a sort of, you know, a prototype Mamma Mia. I think, how did I have the nerve to do that? And then I directed, you know, the Gilbert and Sullivan, and I was bossing all these people and I choreographed it.
You ended up as president of the Footlights, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I was the first woman president. But I think that was just a sort of a moment, really. I think our mutual friend Martin Bergman, who was president a couple of years before me, and then Robert Bathurst was president the year before me. And I think Martin sort of decided this would be a great sort of thing to do, to have a woman. And when I became the president, I thought, why have they never had a woman to do this before? Because basically it's a load of slog. Yeah. You know, you've got to book the tour, you've got to, you know, maintain the club room. You know, it's like, why did a woman never do this before? It's a pain in the bum.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah.
But then that theme carries on through your career. You were also the first female comedy producer at Radio 4, weren't you?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and that was another story of like, you know, what the hell am I doing here? It was... yes, in a corridor full of men. I mean, well, there were women as well, but the women were all secretaries.
Mm.
And the women had to sort of, you know, bring cups of tea. And apparently there was the head of the light entertainment department at that time, which always makes me laugh because, you know, and this is the heavy entertainment department, you know. We have the light entertainment, and here we have the heavy entertainment, we do the drama. but this guy was head of the light, and he was called Bobby J.
Mm.
And Bobby J was like, hello, and he had a sort of moustache. and apparently he gathered the male producers when I was due to arrive and said, now, look, we might have to sort of, you know, bear in mind, you know, we've got a woman coming in to be a producer, you know, bear in mind, might be certain times of the month where we have to tread a bit carefully, you know, and all that. And... because Jimmy Mulville and Jeffrey Perkins and Jamie Ricks were all producers there at the time, and so it was an amazing time, actually. I mean, it was a real baptism of fire because you had to sort of go around trailing other producers, so watching what they were doing, and then suddenly you got thrown in at the deep end. And because of the way programmes were scheduled, so there was Weekending, which was like the topical satirical show of the time. So there was that. And then there were sort of all the panel games and things like that. And I had to do this panel game called The Law Game, which was devised and written by a man called Brad Ashton, who used to run the Brad Ashton School of Comedy. And he had the worst toupee you've ever seen in all the world. It was transfixingly bad.
Worse than Frankie Howard's?
Oh, much worse than Frankie Howard's. It had a little sort of straight fringe at the front and this very sort of like arresting shade of auburn. And he wrote this thing where there would be a bunch of actors, sort of like actors from the radio rep, and they'd have to act out a scene. And then a panel of celebrities would have to guess whether the scene was legal or illegal or whether they were guilty or not guilty.
Sounds like a winner.
Yeah, it was a real winner. It was absolutely... And then I did a pilot of a sort of sketch show called 3+1, where I sort of reversed the formula of there being three men and one woman in a sketch show, and we had three women and one man.
Mm.
And in the pilot, we had Alison Steadman, Denise Coffey, and Emma Thompson. And then Nicholas Le Prevost was the straight man. And then Emma was too busy to do the series.
Really?
Yeah. But yes, I mean, it nearly got taken off the air, 3+1, for using the word orgasm in a sketch.
Look, I'm shocked. I'm stunned.
Different times, Mike. Different
Even today,
times.
I'm taken aback by the use of that word. I'm going to have to edit that out, Jan. You know.
I know.
I'm so sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry about that.
But I can see what you mean about that ridiculous confidence that you have at that age. I mean, it is sort of ridiculous, isn't it? Because you don't really know what you're doing, and then you just go, "Yep, I'll do it."
Yeah, and I think it's the sort of the thrill of new things, the thrill of opportunity. And I guess you either think, well, I am absolutely fucking terrified. I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
Or you think, I'm terrified, I'm going to do it.
Mm.
And I thought, I'm terrified and I'm going to do it. And I can remember, you know, being on the phone to my mum and dad going, oh, my God, what am I going to do? You know? And also when I directed the Footlights Review, which was sort of how I got the job as a producer, the Footlights Review that won the first Perrier Award, and it had, you know, Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie and Emma Thompson in it, so Tony Slattery.
Mm.
So it naturally did very well. But directing that, you know, was pretty sort of nerve-wracking as well.
Mm. Well, it's impressive, though.
Yeah.
All right, Jan, we're going to take, I don't know how we came to this, but we're going to go back and we're going to take that lovely cup and saucer.
The cup and saucer.
Beautiful fine bone china.
Yeah.
And we're going to put that carefully into the time capsule
yeah.
to remind you of that time and that yeah. that journey that you made in those in your younger days.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So what's your second item?
My second item is a microphone, because the voice has been such a kind of huge part of my life. And also, kind of following on from what we've just been talking about, really, I guess when I started doing voiceovers, you know, when in the early days of doing voiceovers, you know, when you have your headphones on and you're talking into the mic and you suddenly become aware of your own voice. It's like people say, oh, I hate hearing myself, you know, hearing myself back on an answering machine or something. But when you're, you know, in a studio and you hear your own voice, and while I, you know, I mean, I'm from the Wirral, from Merseyside, so my voice, you know, I didn't have a voice like that, you know, wasn't kind of, you know, like really scouse or nothing like that. But I did have a voice that was kind of probably more like that, you know, that was with those particular vowel sounds. And so I'd hear myself saying, and I still do, actually, I still hear those sounds from time to time, like instead of saying go, you say go. Mm. And instead of saying singing, you say singing, and those sorts of things. And so I'd hear myself, you know, in the headphones and hear these. And gradually over the years, and I think through being at Cambridge and then moving to London as well, but hearing your own voice back at you kind of thing. And I remember there was this advert with Sherry Lungi doing the voice of a Dulux soft sheen. And she would talk about Dulux soft sheen, you know, and these beautiful colours and this beautiful dark brown voice. And so I sort of modelled myself, you know, my voiceover voice on Sherry Lungi. And and actually, I did a voiceover with her the other week. And I was so ill when we did these voiceovers. I hardly had any voice. But luckily, it was one of those things where you could, you know, because it was the Daily Mail. You know, in the Daily Mail this Saturday, Michael Mosley tells us his recipes to solve diabetes and, you know, take you back to it. And it was like, so it goes up, but I didn't really have any voice. I mean, I was almost Claire Rayner, you know, I was almost kind of. You
know. Yes.
Claire Rayner was one of the first impressions I did when I did this review called Ha Bloody Ha with my then husband Steve and Nick Wilton. And I did this impression. I did it on Carrot's Lib actually as well on the telly of Claire Rayner going, Will you do that for me, lovey? Will you ring me up and tell me when you've done it, lovey? Will you do that? And you do talk very, very fast, very, very, and always sort of run out of breath before she got to the end of the sentence. And anyway, Claire Rayner came to see this. We did this review at the gate at the Latchmere in Battersea. And Claire Rayner came to see it and she loved it. She, you know, she thought it was a real laugh. And anyway, it turned out that the reason that she talked in this way, running out of breath, was because she actually had emphysema. But I used to say, you know, Claire Rayner, you know, she took it in very good heart. Crap lungs, but very good heart. But she was one of the first, I did her on Carrot's Lib and then that was one of the first things I was asked to do on Spitting Image.
Mm.
But the microphone, I mean, I just think the voice is such an amazing, it can be so empowering and so disempowering. And the power of the recorded voice, I mean, spoken and singing, is such a huge thing. There's this fabulous song called Mon Coeur S'ouvre à ta voix. It's from an opera. I think it's Samson and Delilah, but my heart opens at your voice. Mm. And I think the power of the voice is such a powerful thing. It's like when I can remember when I had young kids and I lost my voice. And when you can't tell your kid, you can't say, stop doing that, you know, Alfie, don't do that to Lenny. When you can't speak to your kids or shout at your kids, probably, it's so disempowering. I always wonder why politicians who have crap voices, for example, don't sort of work a bit more at them.
Yeah.
Because if politicians had a voice like Emily Thornberry's voice, you know, if everybody spoke like Emily Thornberry, you know, they might take more notice of them.
Yes.
But you know, when you speak like Priti Patel, you know, where you're saying hang in and, you know, relaxing and, you know, you are not, you know, sounding any of your words ending in gur. And, you know, that's a smirking at the same time. You know, people just sort of, I just think they should take much more notice of how they sound.
Yeah.
Because it's such an important part of how you come over.
But you're known amongst all your friends as somebody who you will start impersonating the person you're talking
to. Well, that's not strictly true, Mike, actually, because I'm really not one of these people who does impressions that does them all the time.
No.
I think you're probably specifically thinking of one of our friends in common.
Yes.
Which is lovely Helen Atkinson Wood. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, I know, but I have seen you do me at me.
Really?
Yeah, just to sort of take the mickey out of my... to point up the absurdity of what I'm saying.
Oh, right, okay.
Have you always had that ability, or did you develop it as a result of sort of being asked to?
Well, I think I always had it. I mean, like when I was a kid, you know, it was the sort of the well-worn story. I used to impersonate the teachers. You know, then all the other teachers would ask to see the impressions of the other teachers, you know, so... And I look back on it now, I think it must have been a bit weird because, I mean, you know, they were probably quite good. So it must have been quite sort of uncanny for these teachers to see themselves, you know, these impressions done of them by this 14-year-old kid. But yeah, so I started off doing it. But I never thought, I mean, I wanted to be Glenda Jackson.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be a Tern.
No.
And I still sort of, you know, have a very...
You're like a sponge, I think.
Well, yes. Yes, I'm very absorbent. I sometimes, you know, love the fact that I can do impressions and I sometimes hate it.
Yes.
Because the whole business of being a Tern, I mean, you know, you're talking about wanting to do serious work, wanting to be Glenda Jackson. I think when you're a comedian, people often kind of think, well, you know, they're a comedian, can they act? But when you're an impressionist, it's kind of another step. And it's been sort of like quite... tough to say, well, actually, you know, I am an actress as well.
Yes. Is she really doing her own voice?
Yeah. And also the whole thing of like, you know, if you're on a chat show or something, an impressionist would always be asked to do their impressions.
Mm.
And I said, I think, you know, you're not asking Judi Dench to do, you know, Cleopatra. Why are you, you're asking Judi Dench about her process or her background or what she thinks about stuff. Ask me, you know, it's like I'm not just these voices.
No.
So it is a bit of a double-edged sword, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember in the 80s when we were doing Spitting Image and when we were doing Brunch on Capital, which was also kind of, you know, topical, satirical, taking the piss out of the news kind of thing. And I just sort of got so sick of taking the piss.
Yeah.
You know, I got really sick of that thing of constantly sort of going and kind of getting at people. And I really, really wanted to kind of immerse myself in some poetry and some stories and feel kind of enriched and kind of ennobled by some lovely words, you know, and not just kind of going, hey, so-and-so talks like this, you know. It just seemed so sort of mean-spirited somehow when you do it too much and to the exclusion of everything else. I mean, I think that's the thing, isn't it? You want variety. I mean, it's like when you do voiceovers all the time, you know, and you think, God, if I say creamy smooth or lemon fresh one more time, I'm going to kill myself. but if you're doing a few voiceovers alongside your lovely part in, at the RSC, that's great, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you use a microphone beautifully, you always have. So I'm going to put in a very good quality one for you.
Very nice.
So we'll put that lovely microphone, good quality one, into the time capsule with your cup and saucer.
Lovely.
So that's two items. What's the next one? Okay, we're going to take a short break here for some adverts. We'll be back with you very soon.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Right, welcome back. Okay, let's find out what the third thing is that Jan Ravens would like to put in her time capsule.
The next one is Alan Bennett.
Oh.
I'm sorry, Alan, to inter you in this capsule, but I'm afraid there's nothing else for it. Yeah, the whole business of Alan Bennett. I mean, right from the beginning, there's so many things about Alan Bennett that I want to kind of, you know, leave for posterity. And one of them, of course, is being at the kind of at the vanguard of the sort of 60s satire movement. Because that I've sort of spent a lot of my career in satire, taking the piss out of people and being mean-spirited. But, you know, at the beginning of the 60s, I think it was 1960, you know, when they did Beyond the Fringe, really up until then, there'd been a kind of culture of deference, really, as far as politicians were concerned. And people would never take the piss out of politicians, basically. And it wasn't until Beyond the Fringe, when Peter Cook did his, you know, his Macmillan,
yes,
that they really sort of started satirising politicians. And there's this actually brilliant story of Peter Cook. He was doing Macmillan, and Macmillan came to see the show. And everyone was kind of a bit apprehensive because, you know, what was he going to think and da-da-da-da-da. And everyone was apprehensive, apart from Peter Cook, who was like such a kind of mischief maker and lover. I mean, he wasn't really a political satirist so much as a sort of just wanting to be funny and to make these people look funny and absurd. So everyone thought, oh, maybe he'll cut the Macmillan monologue a bit, you know, trim it. But instead of that, he kind of extended it, you know, to a huge degree. And apparently he added this bit where he said, when I've nothing better to do, I like to nip around to my local theatre and see a bunch of sappy, vibrant, urgent young satirists with a stupid great grin spread all over my silly old face. And everyone went, oh, my God, you know, oh, dear, 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 what are we going to, oh, my God. And he was loving it, Peter Cook. Everybody else was mortified. Absolutely mortified. But anyway, that was the start of the 60s satire boom, you know, Beyond the Fringe, and Alan Bennett was there. But more, you know, almost more than that, I love him for his sort of depiction of the sort of lower middle class middle-aged woman, which resonated so kind of piercingly with me, because I'd heard all these voices. I mean, although he's Yorkshire and I'm sort of more Lancashire, I'd heard all these voices when I was a kid. You know, I mean, if my mum was to say, you know, was telling me about going for a coffee with her friends, it would sound like she was in an Alan Bennett play. You know, she'd sort of say, I'd say, oh, who was at the coffee pot, mum? She'd go, well, there was Barbara Bickerstaff, there was Marjorie and Norman Pye, there were Ted and Jean Jelly, and Bill and Bunty Burtonshaw. And I thought, yeah, this is like, and all these voices, you know, come, like, you know, I've just done this Alan Bennett, the Talking Heads thing, which has been like the play that I sort of feel like I've been rehearsing for my whole life, you yeah. know. But yes, yeah, such brilliant rhythms and such brilliant observations and such fantastic jokes. And I just loved it. I mean, the whole thing, it was, I did this one character, Irene Ruddock in Lady of Letters, and she'd sort of complain about everything and write a letter about it. There's this one brilliant bit where she says, after I'd dusted round and done my jobs, I had a walk on to the end and bought a little packet of sausage and some Basildon Bond. Big black hair in the sausage. The other thing is that, of course, if I think if we didn't have Alan Bennett, we wouldn't have Victoria Wood, who is another sort of heroine of mine. And they're sort of in there together, really. Mm. Victoria Wood and all her creations, similarly, of those, you know, those types of women.
Yes.
That sort of echo the Alan Bennett characters in a lot of ways.
That rhythm of writing with a northern voice,
yeah,
is true right through from very erudite, well-educated people, right the way through to the stand-up comics or the comedians of the
yeah.
time.
They had like Al Reed or whatever.
Yeah. Or in fact, Les Dawson.
Yeah.
And I remember just a description. My wife, a face like a bag of spanners. Yeah. It's poetry.
Yeah. No, it is lovely. There's one bit where she says, Irene in Lady of Letters says, thinking back on it, it must have been the doctor alerted the vicar. Came round anyway. Not the old vicar, I'd have known him. This was a young fella, collar and tie, could have been anybody. I didn't take the chain off. I said, how do I know you're the vicar? Have you any identification? Shoves a little cross round the door. I said, what's this? He said, a cross. I said, a cross doesn't mean anything. Youths wear crosses nowadays. Hooligans, they wear crosses in their ears. He said, not like this. This is a real cross, a working cross. It's the tool of my trade. I was still a bit dubious, but I saw he had cycle clips on, so I let him in.
Yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it?
It is. It's so
It is
lovely.
Great writing. You wonder how easily that happens for him, or in fact, if it's actually observation.
I think a lot of it is heard because he uses lots of phrases over and over again, like, you know, so I took up my trusty platinum and dashed off a note. It stood me in good stead as that pen. You know, things like standing you in good stead and things like at the end saying at the finish. So at the finish, it was, you know, or in the finish, he uses that a lot. I mean, it's all sorts of little phrases. And you can just tell that, you know, he's heard his mother and his aunts and, you know, these women that come into the butchers, you know, I think his dad was a butcher. It's just in him, I think.
Yes.
But I don't think any writer writes easily.
No.
I mean, I find writing really hard. And I think that's because I'm used to getting a reaction. I'm used to being a performer and knowing whether people think it's funny because of whether they've laughed or not, or whether they're interested, you know, are they still paying attention? Whereas if you're writing, you just don't know.
No.
And I find that really hard. What I should have done earlier on was to get a sort of regular writing partner. But you sabotage yourself, don't you? You self-edit. You kind of think, oh, no, that's crap. I won't write that before you've even started. And that's the thing that you're really not supposed to do. You're supposed to just write. Just write. If you feel you can't write, just write anything. And yeah. Something might come out.
It's why the Beatles wrote She Loves You, Yeah, 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 Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Our age, they would have gone, oh, that's never going to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to put Alan Bennett into the time capsule. God bless him. There he goes. I'll give him a comfy chair. So what's your fourth item? Remember, one of these has to be something you want to get rid of.
Okay, well, the thing I want to get rid of is a ball.
Mm-hmm.
Because I hate fucking ball games. And, you know, they were the source of such kind of misery to me as a kid, you know, because you always had to do PE, you know, and play rounders and netball and tennis and hockey. Oh, hard balls. Even worse than soft balls. Hard balls. Oh, God, ball games, you know. And I had no hand-eye coordination. Couldn't catch to save my life. You know, did silly girly throws, you know, couldn't throw. And I think as it sort of, you know, it's a huge asset to be good at ball games because it gives you a sense of like being one of the team and one of the lads and kind of, you know, you can join in. And if you can't, if you're sort of doing that all the time when we're waiting to be picked at teams or knowing that, you know, you're going to be last pick.
It's an in, isn't it? It's a way to get into a gang.
I think it's even worse for boys, actually. My three sons, Alfie in particular, actually would have absolutely loved to be good at football. Well, and the others, actually. I mean, they all love football. You know, they absolutely love it. And to have been good at it would have been just amazing. And, you know, they just weren't athletes. But yeah, and then, you know, as you get older, you know, people say, hey, let's all go for a game of rounders. You know, and you think, oh, God, not rounders. The horrible heart. It's a hard ball, isn't it? It's a hard ball. I can't be doing with rounders. Or let's all play tennis, you know, and won't that be lovely? And of course, yes, it would be lovely to play tennis if you could only hit the bloody thing.
The last time I played tennis, I tore my Achilles.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
I know. I'd stepped backwards and heard this loud snap. And I know. I thought someone had hit me with a racket. But I've hardly walked properly since. So I agree with you. I'm not keen on ball games. When I was young, of course, I played them all the time because it was a way to be part of the crowd.
Yeah.
And I was never that great at them, but I was enthusiastic. I would try hard. And that was always appreciated. But if you can't do it, if you just can't do it, it's so unfair that all the other people, all those people who can, look down on you so much.
Yeah. Well, there you go. There's a whole suitcase to unpack there with my therapist, isn't there?
Yeah, quite. Right, okay, I'm going to put a ball in there. But, you know, we'll just chuck it somewhere. It can stay in the bushes.
Yeah.
You know. Right, so we come to your final item.
My final item is I don't know if you're going to want to know about this. My final item gives you inner strength and outer confidence.
Mm-hmm. Is it cocaine?
No, it is. It's a neuromuscular stimulator.
It's what?
It's a neuromuscular stimulator.
Mm-hmm.
And it consists of two little bits, one of which looks a bit like a pager with a sort of face of, you know, the readout on it and some little buttons. And then the other thing is it's like an internal electrode, which is about as big as your sort of finger and thumb put together. And when you're a woman of a certain age, Mike, you find yourself, I don't know if it's the same for men, but when you're a woman of a certain age and you take the dog for a long walk and you kind of go, you get to the front door and you're just putting the key in the door and you say, oh, you just put the key in the door. I'm nearly there. And you know you're nearly there and you're nearly there. And you do a little wee. Now, I went to the doctor about this, and the doctor sent me to this lady, and she said, ah, yes, we've got a name for this, and it's called latchkey incontinence. So she gave me this thing, and so there's you've got your little sort of readout thing with the buttons on it, and then you have your little thing that's about four centimetres sort of oval thing, and you whack it up, and you start your little electrical stimulus going. Have you ever used a slender tone, Mike, or anything of that nature? When you're in the beauty salon, you know, you have a sort of electrical stimulus to try and...
Yeah, I'm in the beauty salon often, but...
Yes, in fact, you're there now.
Probably, almost certainly. Well, I've got people fanning me, but we'll go to the nail bar later.
Yeah, so it's like sort of that sort of muscle stimulator that people sometimes have them on their stomach to sort of, rather than doing sit-ups, you have these sort of muscle things. And similarly, internally, if the muscles are getting, you know, slightly aged and maybe a little bit worn out with all that work they're doing, you can use this electrical stimulator. I just thought it might fox people if it was in the time capsule. They might think, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
And they could have fun finding out, because what I call it, Mike, is my NEU. And the reason I call it my NEU is that it's not entirely unpleasant. And, you know, it's not, you know, it's not, you know, it's nothing to sort of, you know, write home about, but it's just a little sort of, you know, an electrical sort of buzz. And I'm keen to sort of publicise them, because for women of a certain age, this is a problem that, you know, you see all these adverts on the telly. You know, now I've had a baby, I didn't realise that I'd be wetting myself all the time. And now I've got some sexy black tenor lady pants. No, they're paper pants. They're not sexy. What are you talking about? So you don't want to get into all this paper pads and pants and nonsense. It's like everything else. You just need to keep it exercised.
Yes.
And if you've had two forceps deliveries, as I have, you sometimes find that your pelvic floor exercises won't quite cut it, and you need to engage the help of an internal electrode of your neuromuscular stimulator. So I just thought this would be an interesting artifact for future generations to find, because they'll probably find some fabulous way of, you know, keeping you all perky down there.
My dad used to have a thing that gave an electrical pulse that took away pain. What are they
called? Oh, that's a TENS machine, yeah.
TENS machine, yeah.
They used to do, I don't know if they still do. I remember they recommended them, like, you know, for during labour.
Hmm.
You'd have the TENS machine and it was going, and I think basically it's distracted, you know, the sort of electric shock distracted you from the fact that you were having labour pains. So that's my last item, because I think, you know, it's very important that women don't go in for, because there's all sorts of terrible surgeries you can have. Women have been, like, ruined by unscrupulous doctors giving them this TVT treatment, which is just, like, awful and, you know, just wrecks people. So, yes, I'm very keen on the on the muscular stimulation of the pericarm.
But I'm happy to put it in there.
Entirely unpleasant.
I think nearly everybody of a certain age has a little problem with an unexpected wee.
Yeah.
It sounds like something the Queen would say, doesn't it?
Yes, an unexpected wee. The royal wee.
An unexpected one.
Yes.
Jo, that's fantastic. We're going to put that in there, and with a little label saying, please use with discretion.
Yes, yes.
Jan, thank you so much. It's been lovely to talk to you.
Well, it's lovely to talk to you too. And yes, I hope it gives people some sort of pleasure. And some...
I don't care about them. I enjoyed it.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Jan Ravens. If you enjoyed listening, you can subscribe to this podcast on Acast, Spotify, or iTunes, or your own favorite podcast provider. And if you have the time, why not rate the show and leave a short review? We would really, really appreciate it. Thank you. To find out all the latest news and details of all our guests, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You just search My Time Capsule or Mike Fenton Stevens. That's me. Right, this podcast was produced by John Fenton Stevens, and the music is by Pass the Peas Music. It was a cast-off production. Thank you for taking the time to listen. And if you've got a spare hour right now, just click play next, and I'll be back. Or you could just do the hoovering. Lazy good for nothing. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.